The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we'll continue to read from The Week magazine, dated August 24th through the 31st from 2012, and usually around a holiday period like Labor Day. They compress the magazines and they only do one for a two-week period. So we'll be reading some additional articles that we don't normally have time to read from The Week magazine, including the book section and the science and health section. And we'll also pull some articles that we have taken from The Week Online that give some more recent news than what we normally receive as well. And we're going to begin the program today with four highlights from the GOP's convention that just opened up on Tuesday. From Chris Christie's Tough Love to Ann Romney's Ode to Love, this is a look at the best of Tuesday at the Republican National Convention. On Tuesday evening in Tampa, Mitt Romney all but became the official presidential nominee of the Republican Party when New Jersey's delegation to the Republican National Convention pushed him over the 1,144-vote threshold. Romney will formally become the nominee on Thursday after the convention chairman accepts the delegates' vote tally. Less than an hour later, the GOP began its push to boost Romney's image and low popularity numbers and make the party's case against giving President Obama a second term. Now from The Week magazine, here are four highlights from that first night of the GOP convention. The first one, Ann Romney touts love, her husband, and women. The expectations for Ann Romney's primetime speech were sky high, says Jennifer Rubin at the Washington Post. Could she humanize her husband? Could she single-handedly close the gender gap? Time will tell, but her speech from her beginning line, I want to talk to you about love, to her final appeal that her husband will not fail, she certainly delivered as promised. The trouble is, she wasn't just trying to humanize her husband, she was trying to make us love him, says Rachel Larimore at Slate. That's a tall order and unnecessary. Mitt needs us to believe he can fix America. We don't need to love him. Mrs. Romney also poured on the female vote trawling a little thick with her unsubtle, I love you women, says Andrew Sullivan at the Daily Beast. But overall, she was fabulous. With her Julie Andrews style and a Sarah Palin wink, Ann Romney is a performer of real talent and by far the best way to soften up Romney's image. The second highlight from the convention, Chris Christie promotes respect and himself. If Ann Romney was the good cop, says Deborah Saunders at the San Francisco Chronicle, Tuesday's keynote speaker, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, played the bad cop. He delivered a red meat speech for the party faithful, but he also hammered the need to tell hard truths about America's fiscal situation. Ann Romney preached love. Christie vowed we will choose respect over love. Christie did himself a whole lot of good, but maybe not much for Romney, says Howard Kurtz at the Daily Beast. He spent the first two-thirds of the speech talking about himself and then only offered some generic praise for Romney. It was as though the two had never met. Christie was delivering a very old-school, gritty message to a country that needs to hear it, says Lane Filler at Newsday. I think this speech will grow on people. The third highlight from the convention is a handful of mini-stars are born. Christie and Ann Romney were the standouts, but Tuesday was also a night to showcase up-and-coming talent, says Chris Saliza at the Washington Post. And of all the men and women touted as rising stars within the GOP who took the stage, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley shone the brightest. She was poised and relaxed and drew the crowd to their feet, touting her state's voter ID law. Runner-up for the best performance by a rising star goes to Texas Senate nominee Ted Cruz. For my money, says the Washington Post's Rubin, Democrat-turned-Republican Arthur Davis gave the most stirring and poetic address, bashing Obama with humorous jibes and the fervent energy of a convert. I agree, says Newsday's filler. Davis may be a rising star in the party, the speaker they've been craving for years. And the fourth highlight from the convention that just opened on Tuesday of this week, Ron Paul's supporters stage a mini-revolt. When Representative Ron Paul, a Republican from Texas, Romney's last primary rival and self-described undecided voter, strove onto the floor of Romney's tightly scripted convention, says Jeff Zeleny at the New York Times, the slow, orderly, and largely symbolic process erupted in anger, presenting a raucous scene that even the most seasoned delegate said they had not seen in decades. The Paulites were furious about the Republican National Convention booting some of Maine's Paul delegates, but they lost their fight, says the Washington Post's Saliza. Still, optics matter at conventions, and having delegates chanting President Paul is not exactly a dream scenario for the party bigwigs. But no worries, the great Ron Paul revolt will be forgotten by Wednesday, says David Weigel at Slate. Still, between Hurricane Isaac and Hurricane Paul, the convention may be a valuable lesson in Romney's leadership style, says Dana Milbank at the Washington Post. A reputed control freak, Romney seems to expect whatever crisis, natural or man-made, to adapt to him. The Paul Brigade didn't. If Romney wants to be president, he had better get used to adapting himself. Now we'll turn to another election year article from The Week magazine online this week. 2012 presidential election, five reasons that race has become a big issue. Obama supporters charge that Romney is playing the race card with birther jokes and welfare attacks. Wasn't this election supposed to hinge on the economy? For weeks, Mitt Romney's campaign has seemed to be veering away from its focus on President Obama's handling of the economy. For example, Romney has five ads about welfare posted on his website, and just one on the economy. Few pundits expected welfare to be a major issue in this campaign. Sure, Obama has given states more flexibility to design their welfare programs, but Romney's ad suggests falsely, according to several analysts, that the change will gut welfare work requirements and result in the government sending checks to people who are just sitting around. Liberals charge that Romney is pandering to white voters who are resentful of black welfare recipients, and that his recent joke alluding to the fringe birther movement is further evidence that the GOP is trying to make the campaign about race. Nonsense, says former GOP presidential candidate Newt Gingrich. If anything, Newt says it's Democrats who are being racist by assuming welfare ads are attacks on blacks. In an election that was supposed to be about the economy, why has the debate suddenly turned to race? Here are five possible reasons, according to The Week magazine. First of all, Romney's focus on the economy wasn't working. Polls are making it clear that harping on the dismal economy won't be enough to boot President Obama from office, says Josh Marshall at Talking Points Memo. So the Romney campaign has concluded something more is going to be necessary. And more, in this case, is wading back into the culture war. Specifically, a new campaign angled on race and President Obama has an alien presence in American life. Brace yourselves, because the sprint toward November 6th is going to be a birther-palooza with a hard-edged focus on race. The second reason that race is an issue, Romney knows white voters are his only chance. Team Romney would be dreaming if it expected big gains among black and Latino voters, says Thomas Edsall at the New York Times. That leaves Romney with no option other than to adopt a strategy to drive up white turnout. That means blowing the dog whistle of racism, resorting to a campaign appealing to racial symbols, images, and issues that pit middle-class whites against the minority poor, in the tradition of the notorious 1988 Willie Horton ad that Republicans used against Michael Dukakis. The third point about race, Democrats are just being quick to call Obama's critics racist. Liberals everywhere are sputtering in indignation about perceived racism in Romney's welfare attacks, said Ala Pundit at Hot Air. Some even accuse the GOP's ad team of darkening Obama's skin. Sound familiar? It should. Obama backers leveled the same charges at Hillary Clinton's ad team during the 2008 primaries, back when she was a horrible racist and not a wonderful post-partisan feminist icon and diplomat. Be warned, if you criticize the liberal welfare policies of America's first black president, his supporters are going to call you a racist. The fourth point, race gets people's attention. There's nothing inherently racist about Romney's welfare ad, says Ezra Klein at the Washington Post. But if the viewer is racist, or at least racially resentful, the ads effectively conjure images in their minds of shiftless minorities who would supposedly rather wait for a government check than work. In politics, when something moves the needle in your favor, you stick with it. And that's why welfare is now the spine of Romney's 2012 on-air message in the battleground states. And the fifth and final point, the liberal media is using race to smear Republicans. Obama's lapdogs in the press will stop at nothing to get him reelected, says Investor's Business Daily in an editorial. And one way to essentially rig the vote is to discredit Romney by accusing him of having a racist agenda to oust a black president. So instead of having an honest debate about policies, welfare included, we have liberal propagandists like MSNBC's Chris Matthews spewing hateful invective at Republicans and suggesting that by pointing out that more Americans than ever now have to resort to food stamps under Obamanomics, Romney was playing the race card. Now we'll turn from some of the latest news taken from the Week magazine online to an article that is from the magazine that was published just last week for this two-week period. It's entitled The United Kingdom Basking in an Olympic Triumph. Thanks to our spectacularly successful Olympics, the United Kingdom is bursting with patriotic pride, said Eddie Izzard in The Mirror. It's quite a bizarre feeling. We're usually modest to the point of self-deprecation. But from the moment the stunning opening ceremony began, showcasing British cultural and scientific achievement, along with cheeky British humor, patriotism has been cool. How uplifting to cheer for our gold medalists with their multicultural backgrounds, including Mo Farah, who came here as a Somali refugee, and the mixed-race Jessica Ennis. We have finally, as a nation, stopped harking back to the days of the British Empire. This will be seen as the moment Britain grew up into a progressive, liberal, and confident country. We have every reason to be proud, said the Independent in England. In an editorial, this very British affair will surely be known as the Happy Games. In the middle of one of the world's densest, oldest cities, we built arenas, transported a million people from event to event, and kept everyone safe, thanks largely to tens of thousands of smiling volunteers. It's a much-needed reminder to ourselves of the capabilities of this odd little island. Team GB did its bit, said Tim Lott, also in The Independent, raking in the third-largest gold medal haul. But this is about more than sport. These games showed our creative force, our contributions to global culture. It is remarkable for such a small country standing head-to-head with the mighty U.S. in terms of innovation and imagination. But is that where we belong? Asked Matthew Paris in The Times. This was a shindig we couldn't really afford. Staging the games cost $14 billion in public money that we didn't have and won't pay back for decades. While it did cheer us all up for a few weeks, so many things could have gone horribly wrong. London's transport system could easily have collapsed entirely. The only reason it didn't is that almost the entire population of the city fled for the duration. I, for one, am happy the games are over, said Peter Hitchens in the Daily Mail. The enforced gaiety was creepy and oppressive. Those who dared to criticize the excruciating opening ceremony as too much leftist twaddle were pilloried. Yes, it's great that we won all those medals, but would you rather have Australia's thriving economy or Britain's medal tally? Games aside, the nation is still broke, disorderly, badly educated, and gravely troubled by the greatest wave of mass immigration in our history. Has the winging already resumed? Said Alison Pearson in the Daily Telegraph. After such a lovely holiday from pessimism, spare me the squabbles about the costs and the aftermath. For a fortnight in the best summer we could remember, Great Britain did her personal best. It was beautiful, and we were happy. Those are all articles from the United Kingdom about the Olympics. Now, as promised, we'll turn to the health and science section of the Week magazine for this week. We'll begin with an article entitled The Sweltering Reality of Climate Change. The relentless heat and drought broiling the U.S. this summer is definitely caused by man-made climate change, a new study asserts. Scientists at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies reviewed 60 years' worth of climate data and found that on average, extreme summer heat occurred on far less than 1% of the surface of the globe before 1980. Over the past three decades, however, that number has soared to as high as 13%. Man-made global warming is not some scientific theory, said NASA scientist James Hansen. We are now experiencing scientific fact. Hansen, a climate change activist who is sometimes called the godfather of global warming, says his statistical study proves that extreme weather events such as this year's heat wave, last year's fierce Texas drought, and the 2010 heat waves in Russia and the Middle East are occurring at least 10 times more frequently than they did decades ago. He predicts that in coming years, such events will become even more frequent and severe. This July was the hottest month ever recorded in the U.S., and 2012 may be the hottest year ever. Some climatologists say it's still not possible to make a certain link between climate change and specific weather events, but Hansen disagrees. You would not have these extremes without global warming. The next item from the Health and Science section is called the sexiest seasons. Human beings become friskier in early summer and early winter, new research has found. Villanova University psychologist analyzed Americans' Google searches over 5 years and discovered a semi-annual jump in words related to sex. Whether it was searches for eHarmony or brothel, there was this exact same pattern, study author Patrick Markey tells MyHealthNewsDaily.com, one above-average spike in June and July and another in December and January. Previous research into birth records, condom sales, and rates of abortion and sexually transmitted diseases has suggested heightened pursuit of intercourse during those months. One reason for the seasonal amorousness could be that during winter holidays or summer vacations, being around more people or being around people more often triggers an increased desire for connection. Markey says it could also be that humans are hormonally hardwired to copulate at those times, perhaps because giving birth in early spring or autumn presented an evolutionary advantage for our earliest ancestors. The next item is entitled, How to Lock in Memories. Simply shutting your eyes and relaxing after learning something new may be the best way to remember it. LiveScience.com reports this. Researchers at the University of Edinburgh asked a group of healthy volunteers between the ages of 60 and 90 to listen to stories and try to remember as many details from them as possible. Then some were asked to close their eyes for 10 minutes in a quiet room and daydream about anything they liked, while others were asked to play a computer game. When it came time to recall what they'd heard, both 30 minutes afterwards and a week afterward, the volunteers who had rested remembered far more details than those who hadn't. That suggests that the formation of new memories is not completed in mere seconds, and that activities that we are engaged in for the first few minutes after learning new information determine how well our brains absorb it, says study author Michaela Dewar. Previous research has shown that sleep is crucial to crystallizing memories, but taking a brief waking rest without studying what you've learned or facing any external distractions appears to return similarly beneficial results. The next item is house cats' secret predations. When let outside, the typical house cat turns into a killing machine. University of Georgia researchers made that discovery when they strapped specially designed cameras onto the collars of 60 domestic felines and observed their behavior over a week. They found that 44% of the cats went hunting, but they brought home only about a quarter of their prey, including lizards, snakes, frogs, chipmunks, monks, and birds. That suggests that previous estimates of the damage that America's 74 million house cats do to local wildlife were probably too conservative, because they didn't include the animals that cats ate or left behind, study author Carrie Ann Lloyd tells USA Today. The American Bird Conservancy says that cat predation is one reason why one in three American bird species is in decline. The footage, the first to offer a long-range picture of what domestic cats do when they roam outdoors, also showed that the pets are often a danger to themselves. 85% engaged in potentially life-threatening behaviors like crossing roads, eating and drinking unknown substances, and exploring tight spaces. Several of the felines, unbeknownst to their owners, also routinely visited a second family for extra treats and petting. And now we'll take a look at the health scare of the week, the heavy toll of worry. Taking the stresses of everyday life too much to heart could increase your risk of cardiovascular disease and even shorten your life. A new British study of more than 65,000 people found that those who reported feeling even mild anxiety of the sort that distracted them depleted their self-confidence or sometimes kept them awake at night, were 16% more likely to die over a 10-year period than those with no such worries. About 1 in 4 people experiences mild anxiety, but most remain untreated because they don't have sufficient symptoms to be diagnosed with an anxiety disorder or a depressive illness, researcher Tom Russ of the University of Edinburgh tells Health.com. Mild stressors, including concerns about work, finances, or relationships, are so common that they're virtually impossible to avoid, says University of Bristol psychiatrist Glenn Lewis. But coping strategies such as exercise, meditation, or talk therapy might reduce their biological impact. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program here, we're reading from the Week magazine dated August 24th to the 31st. It essentially covers a 2-week period because of the upcoming Labor Day holiday. And therefore, we have the opportunity to read some other sections from the magazine that we don't normally have the time to read. As you know, our program runs 1 hour in length, and of course, we have to be selective about the sections that we read from. But when we do have one of these duplicate weeks here where one issue covers 2 weeks, I really enjoy it because it gives me a chance to share a few more articles from the magazine with you. I'd like to take a look at the art section here, specifically the review of reviews about books. The first article here is the Book of the Week, and it is entitled The Mansion of Happiness, A History of Life and Death. And this is by Jill Lepore. That's L-E-P-O-R-E. It might seem odd that a book about life and death would begin with Milton Bradley, said Danny Shapiro in the New York Times, but that's the way Jill Lepore's mind works. The Harvard historian and New Yorker writer kicks off her trenchant and fascinating chronicle of our culture's shifting ideas about human life and its ends in 1860, the year the young American toy maker decided to retool a popular British board game called The Mansion of Happiness. Players in that older game sought to dodge vices and accumulate virtues in order to outrace their fellow pilgrims to heaven. And that is outrace their fellow pilgrims to heaven. For his uniquely American adaptation, Bradley decided to chuck the piety. In his version, originally called The Checkered Game of Life, players raced through life stages seeking maximum material wealth. Quite obviously, our ideas about life's purpose had changed. One of the pleasures of Lepore's work is the way she uses a single, deftly chosen artifact to crack open a wider cultural vista, said Laura Miller in Salon.com. In one potent chapter, she revisits the case of Karen Ann Quinlan, a comatose young woman who in 1976 sparked a new national debate about the right to die when her parents tried to have her removed from life support. Lepore also excels at connecting disparate threads. An image from the Stanley Kubrick film 2001, A Space Odyssey, of a fetus floating in deep space reminds her of a famous 1965 Life magazine photo, a photo spread that detailed the stages of fetal development and thus helped fuel the right to life movement. Both, she says, represent fantasies of prenatal life, because both leave mothers out of the picture. Though Lepore's connections are sometimes too coy, they often illuminate and inspire. Like Bradley's game, Lepore's book is distinctly American, said Buzzy Jackson in the Boston Globe. It doesn't attempt to tell readers what to think. Instead, the whirlwind of people and concepts serves to illustrate just how transient our contemporary opinions might be. A chapter on breastfeeding, for example, shows how Americans have flip-flopped. In some eras, the practice is hallowed. In others, it's indecent. Discussing Quinlan, Lepore points out that the question of whether to pull the plug couldn't even have been asked in the 1950s. As in Milton Bradley's game, the future is ever uncertain. The next roll of the dice could, in fact, change everything. And that was about the book called The Mansion of Happiness, A History of Life and Death by Jill Lepore. The next article is about the novel of the week in the Week magazine, and it's entitled Where Do You Go, Bernadette? By Maria Semple. The protagonist of Maria Semple's fantastic, funny new novel is full of complaints, said Carolyn Kellogg in the Los Angeles Times, an acclaimed architect before some huge, hideous thing caused her to flee Los Angeles. She's forever venting her disdain for her adopted Seattle, for the other mothers at her daughter's school, and for virtually everything about Canadians. Then on the eve of a family trip to Antarctica, of all places, she vanishes. Semple's marvelous characters always surprise, and she's constructed the story as a modern epistolary novel, told through emails, police reports, and occasional straight narration by Bernadette's 15-year-old daughter, Bee. You could stop and pay attention to how apt each new format is, how rarely Simple repeats herself, and how imaginatively she unveils every bit of information, said Janet Maslin in the New York Times, but you would have to stop laughing first. Full of endearing moments and sublime satire. Where do you go, Bernadette, is divinely funny literature. And again, that's by Maria Simple. Where do you go, Bernadette? Now, every week in the Week magazine, they offer the book list, which is a list of the best books chosen by a particular writer or author. And this week, it was books chosen by Molly Ringwald. Molly Ringwald gained fame as a member of Hollywood's Brat Pack, starring in such films as The Breakfast Club and 16 Candles. Below, she picks the fiction and poetry that inspired her just-published debut novel, When It Happens to You. The first one that she recommends is called Mating by Norman Rush. Rush, who spent time in Botswana with the Peace Corps, used that experience to craft this National Book Award winner about a female anthropologist who treks through the Kalahari Desert and falls for the visionary founder of a secret utopia. Mating is both a brilliant novel of ideas and a stunning story of what happens when love becomes tangled with obsession. The next recommendation by Molly Ringwald here is The Stone Diaries by Carol Shields, a fictional autobiography of an ordinary woman spanning from conception until death. Shields, who died in 2003, wrote from an unapologetically female perspective, rendering the experience of being a woman with startling insight and a powerful intellectual breath. The next book recommended is The Elementary Particles by Michael Houellebecq. I was living in France when this polemical novel was published. Houellebecq's story of two half-brothers raised apart incited defenders and detractors in every French home. It was fascinating to watch a work of literature virtually divide a nation. Houellebecq was either the greatest French novelist since Balzac or a pornographer and a nihilist. While I don't agree with every opinion he expresses, I admire his audacious and unflinching voice. The next book recommended is What We Talk About When We Talk About Love by Raymond Carver. Carver's economy with language and the power of what he doesn't say resonated with me as a reader and later as a writer. These masterful stories are essential reading for any aspiring writer of short fiction. Molly Ringwald also recommends Birds of America by Laurie Moore. Every story in Laurie Moore's collection is powerful, but if I had to choose a favorite, it would be People Like That Are the Only People Here, the story of a mother grappling with her infant son's cancer. It takes my breath away every time I read it. And finally, Molly Ringwald, the actress and now writer, recommends New and Selected Poems, Volume 1, by Mary Oliver. Mary Oliver writes about the natural world with an incredible sense of humanity and grace. And now, finally, from the book section here, we'll take a look at the author of the week. Her name is Caitlin Moran. Caitlin Moran is preparing to mount her own one-woman British invasion, said Jesse Ellison in the DailyBeast.com. After 20 years of pretending to be normal while working at the buttoned-up London Times, the 37-year-old columnist created a smash hit in the UK last year with her brash autobiography, How to Be a Woman. Newly released in the U.S., the book offers a funny, unabashedly honest take on modern womanhood. So much of being a woman is about keeping secrets, Moran says. True things about being a woman, bleeding, masturbating, being pregnant, you've led to believe that if you're ever truthful about all these bad things, you'd be socially ostracized. The thing that I've realized is you actually do say these things, nothing bad happens. Moran's book is more than just an autobiography, said Peggy Orenstein in Slate.com. At its core is a spirited defense of contemporary feminism. described by Moran as Germaine Greer's The Female Eunuch, written from a bar stool, it takes women to task for, among other things, considering feminism unfashionable. What part of liberation for women is not for you? Moran writes. Is it freedom to vote? The right not to be owned by the man you marry? Vogue by Madonna? Jeans? Did all that good stuff get on your nerves? Her ultimate goal, says Moran, is revolution, to change the world for the sake of her young daughters. I have 6 years to make it into a feminist paradise so my little girls won't get screwed up. And again, the author of the week there is Caitlin Moran. And you may have heard a program that we have on the Triangle Radio Reading Service this year. It's called So All May Read. It was a documentary program about the North Carolina Library for the Blind and the Physically Handicapped. If you have not had the opportunity to hear that program, it is available at the TriangleReadingService.org. That's TriangleReadingService.org. You can click on and listen to that program. And I would strongly suggest that you do that when you have an opportunity. It tells you about all the great services that are available from the North Carolina Library for the Blind to anyone who is visually impaired or physically handicapped. It's an amazing service that includes the largest large print book collection in the state of North Carolina. It also includes a Braille library, but probably the most attractive and the most popular part is the Talking Book Library. They now have a new digital talking book machine that you can get absolutely free if you're a patron, and you can request books anytime you want, and they're absolutely free as well. So if you were or are an avid reader and your sight is not quite as good as it used to be, then please consider contacting the North Carolina Library for the Blind in Raleigh. It's easy to find, and either online or you can find the telephone number easily, and give them a call and ask them how you can become a patron if you are not one already. There are approximately 11,000 people in the state of North Carolina who are patrons of the library and who enjoy the many benefits of the North Carolina Library for the Blind every day. You're listening to our reading of the Week magazine here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. Since we have begun with the convention process this week with the Republican convention and, of course, the Democratic convention coming up in the next couple of weeks, there was an article in the Week magazine called Getting the Flavor of the Two Cities Where the Conventions Are Being Held. The first one, of course, Tampa. The second one is right here in our own state of Charlotte, North Carolina. So I thought I would share these articles with you as well. The first one is Tampa, host of this year's Republican National Convention. Sports museums and nature tug at the sleeve in Tampa, said Andrea Sachs in the Washington Post. Anyone attending a convention in this mild-mannered Florida city will be rewarded if they do some exploring. Even when the NFL's Buccaneers aren't playing, the team's home stadium indulges visitors' football fantasies by offering tours that include a stroll onto the field, into a locker room, and aboard the large pirate ship that looms above one end zone. The Museum of Science and Industry lets visitors geek out on such brainy kids' topics as mummies, dinosaurs, and my closet obsession, extreme weather. A simulator puts you right in the center of a hurricane with 75-mile-per-hour winds. Most worthy of a long layover, though, is historic Ybor City, a small-scale neighborhood that once produced more cigars than Cuba. Italian Americans outnumber Cuban immigrants in today's Ybor City, but reminders of its vibrant heyday are everywhere. And now we'll turn to the Democratic party town, Charlotte, North Carolina. The host city of the Democrats' convention is pure New South, said Sarah Arthon in CNN.com. Native charlatans are actually hard to find in this city of 730,000 people, which has become a melting pot of accents and cultures. A lot of newcomers are drawn to the city by its big banking institutions. Bank of America and Wells Fargo East Coast offices are located here. But the mild weather and its proximity to the beach and the mountains are what entice people to lay down roots. The resulting diversity has generated an eclectic restaurant scene in which ethnic food coexists with such southern standbys as barbecue and the best fried chicken you will ever eat. Cultural attractions vary widely, too, even when you consider only the two biggest to open in the last few years, the Levine Center for the Arts. A complex comprising three museums and an intimate theater is one, and the other is, of course, the NASCAR Hall of Fame. That from the travel section of The Week magazine for this week. Now we'll take a look at some news items from the business section of The Week magazine. Again, one of those sections we don't have the opportunity to look at too often, but there are always a few interesting articles. The first one here is entitled Euro Crisis, Eurozone Economy Slumps. The Eurozone edged closer to its second recession in 3 weeks this past week, says James Fontanella Kahn in the Financial Times. After zero growth in the first quarter of the year, GDP in the Eurozone shrank by 0.2%. between April and June, though two consecutive quarters of negative growth define an official recession, the Eurozone is to all intents and purposes already there, said financial analyst Howard Archer. Germany and France were two relative bright spots. Exports and domestic spending pushed Germany to a 0.3% expansion, while France narrowly escaped a highly anticipated contraction by posting 0% growth. But that modestly encouraging news was offset by sharp contractions in Greece, Spain, Italy, and Finland. With the economic malaise spreading, the German economy can defy gravity for only so long, said Alex Britton in WSJ.com. Germany's growth rate, while positive, was half what it had been in the previous quarter, and business confidence is falling. Such signs of weakness in Europe's biggest economy put pressure on European Central Bank chief Mario Draghi to stimulate the Eurozone economy, but he'll have to set tough conditions to avoid throwing money to the wind. Now let's take a look at an interesting article called Making Money: What the Experts Have to Say. Investing for the Disaffected. Fed up with the stock market? Asked Ron Lieber in the New York Times. With headlines full of Wall Street scandals, plenty of investors want nothing to do with the profit-making players of the American financial system. Yet they still need to save and invest in order to retire in comfort. For an alternate route to financial security that bypasses the typical players, consider investing in municipal bonds, which help pay for local roads and schools. You can also invest in real estate. If you pay off the mortgage after you retire, the rental income becomes sort of an annuity. Or try investing in loans given to other people through services like Lending Club or Prosper, which are delivering returns around 7%. All of these routes are risky, but if you are convinced that the Wall Street game is rigged, sticking to your principles may be its own reward. The next part of this section is called Finding Profit Overseas. Investors hunting for healthy dividends should look to emerging markets, said Janice Revelle in Fortune. Dividends there now average more than 3% compared with just over 2% for the Standard & Poor's 500 index. And yields look set to rise. As global growth slows, companies will have to deliver larger payouts to keep attracting foreign capital. In some countries, dividends are mandatory. Brazil, for instance, legally requires firms to pay out at least 25% of their profits. Slowing growth abroad is also lowering share prices, creating great buying opportunities. It won't always be smooth sailing, but smart investors will be paid a relatively generous income to ride out the voyage. Playing the housing rebound. For investors, home is no longer a four-letter word, said Joe Light in SmartMoney.com. Home prices last quarter rose by their biggest percentage in 7 years, and major market players like Warren Buffett are betting on the sector's continued recovery. Investors who want to participate in the rebirth of a sector they once left for dead should focus on three main avenues: investing in home builders, buying real estate investment trusts, and buying and managing individual properties. The value of construction firms dropped so much in the bust that even without a boom in new home sales, analysts expect the sector to grow. REITs, which own malls, apartment buildings, and office parks, have been among the best performers of the year. As you know, if you're a regular listener to our Reading of the Week magazine, we normally about this time switch to an article called The Last Word, which is always very entertaining and often inspiring. And, of course, we read The Last Word from this two-week edition last week, so I won't repeat that, obviously. But I found another article that's very similar to The Last Word and its style and tone, and I thought you might enjoy it. It's a very sweet article. The title is 72 Years Together, The Couple Who Died Holding Hands. After 72 years of marriage, Norma and Gordon Yeager died within 1 hour of each other and were buried in a single coffin. Here's a love story for the ages, or the movies. Iowa couple Norma and Gordon Yeager were both in their 90s and had been married 72 years when they were hospitalized following a car accident. The nurses and doctors kept the two together in the intensive care unit, and they lay there, barely responsive, but holding hands. Gordon passed away, and exactly 1 hour later, Norma followed him, still holding his hand. "They just loved being together," says their son Dennis. "He always said, 'I can't go until she goes because I got to stay here for her.'" And she would say the same thing. Here, a brief guide to their incredible story. Who was this extraordinary couple? 90-year-old Norma and 94-year-old Gordon Yeager met while Norma was still in high school, and Gordon was working at the Chevrolet garage in State Center, Iowa. They were married on May 26, 1939, the day Norma graduated. They had four children together, one daughter and three sons. Tragically, their two middle children were killed in car accidents. "They believed in marriage," says their son Dennis. "They chose each other, and once they had committed, that was it." How did they die? Last Wednesday, as the couple was driving into town, Gordon mistakenly pulled out in front of another car. The Yeagers were rushed to the hospital following the collision and given a shared room in intensive care. Though they were not really responsive, they held hands as they lay there, side by side. At 3:38 p.m., Gordon passed away, but then his family noticed his heart monitor was still beeping. "It was really strange," Dennis says. Then a nurse looked and saw that the couple's hands were still clasped. Her heart was beating through him, and the monitor was picking it up. Dennis says, at 4:48 p.m., 1 hour after her husband, Norma passed away as well. Neither one of them would have wanted to be without each other, says their daughter, Donna Sheets. "We were very blessed, honestly, that they went this way." How will they be buried? At their funeral on Tuesday, Norma and Gordon shared a casket and held hands. Once cremated, their ashes will be mixed together. They are survived by their two children, Norma's sister, Virginia Keel, Gordon's brother, Roger, 14 grandchildren, 29 great-grandchildren, and one great-great-grandchild. "We don't hear love stories like Norma and Gordon's anymore," says Lindsay Mannering at The Stir. We hear about lying, cheating, and divorce. Hopefully, there are couples all over the world who share a similar story, because I'd like to live in a world where this is the norm and not the exception. Now we'll turn to the Talking Points section for a couple of articles that you have not heard yet. The first one is entitled, Obamacare, the Impact on the Price of Pizza. President Obama has added a pricey topping to your pizza, said Jeffrey Anderson in WeeklyStandard.com. John Shatner, CEO and founder of pizza chain Papa John's, last week warned that unless the president's health care law is repealed, he'll have to hike the price of a large pie by up to 20 cents. That's because the Affordable Care Act requires companies with more than 50 employees to provide health insurance to their workers or face harsh penalties. Papa John's has 16,500 employees, most of whom are currently uninsured. Papa John's isn't alone in seeing a price increase in their futures, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Other chains, including Burger King, Dunkin' Donuts, and Quiznos, have also said that Obamacare will add up to $30,000 to the annual costs at each restaurant, costs that will all be passed on to customers. Many of those customers are poor. Shatner is a Romney supporter who's playing politics with his pizza, said the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger in an editorial. McDonald's has already said that the cost of Obamacare is no greater than the kind of swings it regularly sees in the prices of meat, potatoes, and other commodities. And those fluctuations don't substantially affect the sale price of a Big Mac. Even if Obamacare does add an extra 20 cents to a pie, said the Louisville Courier-Journal, that's a 1% increase. What a bargain if it means taxpayers no longer have to foot the bill when hard-working but uninsured pizza chefs get ill and end up in the hospital. Two dimes in return for fast food workers finally having health insurance, that's change we can believe in. There's a much larger issue at work here, said Mark Cherise in the Hanover, Pennsylvania Evening Sun. Shatner has a point when he complains about absorbing the cost of providing health care for his employees. For American companies competing in a globalized economy, soaring health care costs are a real competitive disadvantage. In the rest of the civilized world, society as a whole pays those costs in single-payer systems that provide high-quality care to all citizens for about half the price. For now, our system remains deeply flawed. But if paying 20 cents more for pizza means that the poor guy who delivers my pizza can go to a doctor if he gets sick, that's a step in the right direction. And the next article is entitled, Terrorism, Are We Ignoring the Biggest Threat? Who poses a greater terrorism threat to Americans, Islamic radicals or right-wing hate groups? Asked Stephen Cole in NewYorker.com. That's a provocative question in a nation still gripped by the fear sparked by September 11th. But statistics show that the next act of terrorism is just as likely to be the work of right-wing extremists as it is of jihadists inspired by Al-Qaeda. The most recent example, of course, was white supremacist Wade Michael Page, who killed six in a shooting spree at the Sikh temple in Wisconsin. A full 25% of the 302 known terrorist incidents and cases in the U.S. since 2001, a new statistical study has found, have involved people like Wade, anti-government extremists, and white supremacists. The five most potentially destructive planned attacks involving chemical, biological, and radiological materials were all cooked up by right-wing extremists or anarchists, including one nutjob who stocked up on 100 pounds of explosives, 100,000 rounds of ammunition, and enough hydrogen cyanide to kill thousands. So why does the threat of right-wing terrorism seem so poorly publicized? Simple, the right doesn't want it publicized, said Adam Server in MotherJones.com. When the Department of Homeland Security warned publicly in 2009 that right-wing extremist groups posed a major growing threat, conservatives went ballistic, claiming it was an attempt to suppress dissent. What hypocrisy, said Ishan Tharoor in Time.com. Imagine the right's reaction had Page been a Muslim who gunned down white Christians in a Baptist church. Fox News would be full of grim-faced pundits pronouncing upon the pathologies of Islam, while grandstanding politicians would demand an investigation of Islamic radicalization within Muslim American communities. Can someone explain why one type of hate seems more tolerable than another? It isn't, but hate alone is not a crime, said former FBI terrorism investigator David Gomez in NYTimes.com. Law enforcement can intervene only when groups or individuals engage in criminal acts. Would you want people jailed for exercising their constitutional right to free speech? Liberals would welcome that, said Michelle Malkin in NationalReview.com. They think homicidal madmen like Page are no different from Tea Party activists, law-abiding gun owners, and other Americans who embrace the very principles of limited government espoused by our founding fathers. To them, every conservative is a right-wing terrorist. That's a slur, and it is designed to suppress dissent. And as we reach the end of our program here, we'll conclude with a little bit of wit and wisdom from The Week magazine. Their first quote here is, "Finishing second in the Olympics gets you silver. Finishing second in politics gets you oblivion." And that was Richard Nixon, quoted in the Montreal Gazette. "Hobbies of any kind are boring except to people who have the same hobby," says Dave Barry, who is quoted in the New Zealand Herald. "Take care of the luxuries, and the necessities will take care of themselves," Dorothy Parker, quoted in the Dayton, Ohio Daily News. "The truth is lived, not taught." Herman Hess said that, and he was quoted in the Associated Press. "Too much consolation may leave one inconsolable," poet Galway Kennell, quoted in the Boston Globe. "If you're not a sex object, you're in trouble," said Helen Gurley Brown. She was quoted in the DailyBeast.com. And the final quote from this Wit and Wisdom column, "The greater the artist, the greater the doubt. Perfect confidence is granted to the less talented as a consolation prize." And that was a quote from art historian Robert Hughes. He was quoted in the Independent in the United Kingdom. We've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week magazine. Be sure to join me again next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.